So I'm John Philip Sousa to get us started this afternoon from The Bride-Elect, The Dancing Girl. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. I'm Celeste Quinn. Today we hear about the life of Mrs. Theodore Roosevelt, Edith Kermit Roosevelt. Biographer Sylvia Jukes Morris is our guest. Sylvia Morris's biography, Portrait of a First Lady, shows Edith Roosevelt to be an influential but very private woman. Edith was Roosevelt's second wife. His first wife, Alice, died of Bright's disease not long after giving birth to the couple's daughter. Alice's death came on the heels of the death of her mother-in-law. Both women died on the same day, February 14, 1884. Theodore was devastated. He said he'd never remarry, but then a spark was rekindled with his childhood sweetheart. And Edith and Theodore were married in 1886. Our guest, Sylvia Morris, says the story of Edith Roosevelt's life is, by and large, a love story. Morris's book, Edith Kermit Roosevelt, Portrait of a First Lady, was first published in 1980. It is now available in a paperback edition from the Modern Library. Sylvia Morris is also the author of a biography of Clare Booth Luce, Rage for Fame, The Ascent of Clare Booth Luce. Morris is married to Edmund Morris, the biographer of Theodore Roosevelt. Listeners, I invite your questions for Sylvia Jukes Morris. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Sylvia Jukes Morris, good afternoon. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Good afternoon to you, too, and thank you for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's been wonderful to be immersed in the lives of Theodore and Edith Roosevelt here for several days now.
I think you're ODing over there in Illinois, the Roosevelts.
Oh, I don't know. Their lives are oh, it the books are just a joy to read, both yours and Edmund's.
Well, thank you.
How did you become interested in the life of Edith Roosevelt?
Yes, it's one of those chance things that come along, like opportunity knocking. Edmund actually had written a screenplay about the days of Theodore Roosevelt out west, when after that young wife you just described, the death of her, he was so grief-stricken with the death of her and his mother in the same house on the same day that he went to the Dakotas to not only repair his soul, but to also to build up his body, because he was rather sickly by nature. And it was that screenplay, helping Edmund to type that, in the old days when we just had the regular little typewriters, electric typewriters, I helped him out on that, and I said, who's this mysterious woman that he had passed over to marry this gorgeous Alice Lee? And Edmund said, oh, nothing's known about her. She was extremely private. And I said, well, I think I'd like to find out something. Hmm. So I went to the library and found out all I could. It was mostly in books on first ladies. And got the bug, as they say. And then my agent said, oh, she thought she could get me a contract for a biography. And that's how I ended up doing it.
Edith was married to a very public, larger-than-life man. Were you surprised to find that she was such a private woman?
Well, I wasn't surprised, because Edmund had told me that nothing really was known about her, and much wouldn't have been known about her if I hadn't stumbled across a lot of family papers, because there was so little in the public record that I had to go to the living family members. And at that time, two of Edith's own children were still living, Archie, who lived in Florida, and Ethel, who lived out at Oyster Bay, near where she'd grown up. And, of course, Alice Roosevelt Longworth, who was the child of that first marriage, was also still alive in her 90s. So I was able to go to them and then to the grandchildren and find that there was all kinds of correspondence in attics and barns and all over the place that had never been tapped.
And now has all that been collected and has that been cataloged?
As a result of my doing that, I alerted Harvard University to the fact that, because that's where TR's more private personal papers are, and they, over the years, the family donated them. So they now have all been accumulated in the same place.
Hmm. It's interesting that Edith, she collected and apparently liked to tell stories about her ancestors, but was very reticent about her more immediate family, especially her parents.
Yes, and you know, of course, the reason for that. Mm-hmm. It turned out that she came from an extremely good family, equally good to that of Theodore Roosevelt. They were certainly on a par there socially. But her father, who'd inherited a large fortune from shipping, the grandfather had founded this company of ships which plied their trade across the Atlantic from Liverpool to the West Indies and then on to New York. And unfortunately, the father was an alcoholic, and he dissipated quite a lot of that fortune, so that Edith, in her teen years, faced the prospect of a life of impoverished gentility.
And her mother, Gertrude, apparently suffered depression?
Yes, she suffered acutely. She'd actually been a very accomplished singer who'd actually trained in Paris, but came back and, of course, married and ended up having children and not doing anything about her career. So I think a lot of that depression came from unfulfilled ambition and a natural talent just gone to waste.
Yeah.
And then, of course, faced with the lack of income after the early death of Edith's father, they decided to go and live abroad because the dollar would go further, particularly in countries like Italy. And that's what they did just at the time when Theodore came back from the West, having repaired his shattered soul. And although he told his sisters he didn't want to see Edith because he was afraid that he didn't believe in second marriages and he was afraid that some long-suppressed feelings might surface, but they did bump into each other on a staircase. She was leaving his sister's house one day, and these feelings just were revitalized. And by that time, she was committed to going abroad, so she did go ahead. And he followed her, and they were married in London.
Well, let's go back a little bit and talk about their relationship as children, and then as adolescents. They spent so many years in one another's company before they were man and wife.
Yes, in fact, before Edith's family fell on hard times, the Roosevelts invited her, as they did several other small children in the neighborhood, to come to the little house on 20th Street just off Broadway in Manhattan, and join the Roosevelt children in being educated by the Roosevelt governess. And so she literally grew up with him on a daily basis, being taught. And there is a lovely picture of them sitting on the steps of the Roosevelt birthplace, which is now open to the public, by the way. It's the only house in New York, presidential house, that is open to the public. And they would be sitting there reading to each other. And this friendship, of course, continued into adolescence and even to when he went to Harvard. Theodore went to Harvard. And Edith even visited him at Harvard, and the relationship was fine. But then one summer, when he was on vacation, they had some sort of a quarrel. And nobody's ever been able to find out what the quarrel was about. The most TR would ever say was that both of them were both strong-willed and have strong temperaments. And they had a disagreement, a falling out. And it was shortly after that that he saw Alice Lee in Brookline, Massachusetts, while he was still in college, and said, "That girl will not have me, but I will have her." And when he graduated, they married. Mm-hmm. And Edith went to the wedding, and she told her granddaughter that she danced to the soles of her shoes at the wedding. But I always thought that was a little bit more in frustration. But she told the same grandchild that she somehow knew, even then, when he'd married the other person, that somehow, someday, she would marry Theodore Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. Sort of clairvoyant.
What was Alice Hathaway Lee like?
She was a charming, athletic, tall, blonde-haired, extremely attractive girl, and sweet-natured, but not, like Edith, an intellectual. So the consensus in the family was that had she lived, she would have bored Theodore to death eventually. And Edith herself said the same thing. Although they got along quite well, they knew that she was not substantial enough to meet Theodore's raging passion for learning and reading and languages and everything else. Where Edith was his equal. In fact, in some cases, he said that she was more cultured and more scholarly than he was, and certainly better read.
Now, as you mentioned, Edith attended the wedding of Teddy and Alice, and afterwards the women were often in one another's company. Were they friends?
Yes, I don't think they were close friends. I'm sure that Edith, who was aloof at the best of times, would not have found it in her heart, really. It would have been too painful, perhaps, to get too close to Alice Lee. But even though they're seen in photographs together and off on little trips into the country, I doubt there was a great deal of intimacy there. She was more intimate with Corinne, Theodore's sister. That's where the real intimacy was, on the female side.
As Edith was friends with and sweethearts with Theodore, so she was friends with Theodore's sisters.
Yes, indeed, particularly Corinne, as I say, and the older one, Bammy. There was a little rivalry there because Bammy was rather possessive of Theodore, and after the death of Alice Lee, Theodore actually almost gave away the child to Bammy to raise because he couldn't bear to see this child who resembled the mother so closely, and he felt so guilty about the death of the mother that he even avoided calling her by her real name, Alice. So she grew up in the family eventually when Edith and Theodore had their own children, known as Sister, probably because Theodore couldn't bring himself to even say the name Alice.
How did Bammy react to eventually Alice's going to live with Theodore and Edith?
Edith, yes. It was apparently Theodore's idea was that Bammy should keep the child. But when Edith got back from her honeymoon, already pregnant with her first child, Theodore the second, as it were, she said to Theodore, "No, I'm not going to have you having to go to your sister's house to see your own child. She must come and live with us and be raised as one of our own." And I always thought she was extremely smart in that regard, although it was very tough on Bammy. I think it was the right thing to do.
Alice fit right in, and apparently Edith loved that little girl, and Alice, as an old woman, admitted not being very close to her father, but enjoying very much her stepmother.
Yes, and the most telling scene of all, because over the years, you know, the story of the wicked stepmother always comes up, and they're never supposed to get along with the children of the former marriage. But I always thought that the most telling thing to scotch that particular story was that Alice's wedding, which took place in the White House, it was probably the most dazzling social event ever to take place in the White House before or since. And at the end of the ceremony, Alice turned to Edith and put her arms around her and then held her at arm's length and then hugged her again. And I thought that that spoke volumes about the relationship, that she was grateful to her.
Sylvia Jukes-Morris is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of a biography of Edith Kermit Roosevelt, Portrait of a First Lady. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I welcome your questions and comments in Champaign-Urbana. Our telephone number, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And we have a listener waiting to talk with us on the toll-free line from Chicago. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hello, go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure because I thought I heard it cut off. I've always admired Eleanor Roosevelt, Franklin's wife, because of her involvement in various causes, including civil rights. I'd like to know, during Edith's time, women's rights were a very big issue for some people. How did she feel about women getting the right to vote? Did she often lobby her husband Teddy about that?
Yes. In fact, Theodore, you know, wrote his thesis at Harvard on the rights of women to be equal to men. In fact, he thought they were somewhat superior. And he felt a woman should even keep her own name after she married. So he was quite liberated for his time in that regard. But his sister Bammy said, why give the vote for women? Because it only compounds the stupid vote.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Did she live to see the women vote?
Yes,
she did indeed, yes. Yes, Equal Rights Amendment and all of that. She lived through all of that because she lived 30 years after her husband. She didn't die until Truman. She was born in Abraham Lincoln's first term.
Oh, well, then she lived.
She died when Truman was campaigning for his second.
She lived to see everything.
She spanned almost 100 years of American history.
Yeah, she lived to see everything then. She lived to see her Franklin and then all the things that he did.
Yes, she lived through all of that. And she even campaigned for Hoover against her husband's cousin.
Now, that is unusual. That is,
it is unusual, yes.
Yeah, that's highly unusual. Because I know that, I know that Theodore Roosevelt was what they call a trust buster, but I wasn't sure how he felt about the women's right to vote.
Yes, and I don't know whether you're aware of this, but the Roosevelts, the Theodore Roosevelts, were the first to entertain a black man socially at dinner, a private dinner in their own private quarters. He's the first, Booker T. Washington, the great...
Yeah, I read a book about that. I believe they were criticized in the Deep South for that reason.
Oh, terrible. In fact, my husband had trouble putting that in his book because of the vituperation of the editorial columns. It was so strong, the language was so strong. They really got lambasted for it. But Theodore thought it was right. He said, the time has come to change things. And
yeah, the Roosevelts were very progressive, although in fairness to them, I heard that in the 30s they had trouble getting them to support an anti-lynching law because they worried about the powerful Southerners on the committee, what they do with the New Deal legislation. So.
Yes, indeed. But Theodore said again on that score, he said anybody who is so much as witnessed a lynching is forever diminished by just having seen it.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. I find this very interesting.
Yes, thank you for your good question.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Well, what were Edith's views on suffrage?
Edith, I think all her life, believed that a woman should do exactly what she wants. If she wanted to be a doctor, go and get the qualifications and become a doctor. In her own case, her main joy in life, it seems, was breeding, because she had five children, and she had two more pregnancies, actually, in the White House, and one other pregnancy before she got to the White House. So all in all, I guess, she had eight pregnancies. So her thing was really motherhood, in spite of the fact that she was something of an intellectual. She found that her chief career was just being a wife and a mother, and she thought there was nothing wrong with that. But she didn't at all resent the fact that other women preferred to work outside the house.
Did she play any role in the invitation of Washington to the White House, Booker T. Washington?
Well, she would certainly have to agree to it because she had to be the hostess. It was a private dinner, so it was just the family. And so she certainly supported him in that because she was strong-minded and she would always speak her mind about everything. So I'm sure she was in total agreement. And another thing that she became famous for, actually, in her time, was that she introduced the music car to the White House, where she invited great stars of the day like Busoni and Paderewski and Nellie Melbar to sing, and the Vienna Male Voice Choir, and even a whole symphony orchestra at one time, to perform in the White House during the season. And she did this throughout her career there, the whole 7.5 years that she was there, pretty well. And she even had the young Pablo Casals to play in the Roosevelt White House 50 years before he came back as an old man to play for the John Fitzgerald Kennedys.
I remember from Edmund's book when Theodore is arriving in Washington after McKinley has been assassinated, that the White House looks and feels as though, you know, just so dark and depressing. And I imagine when Edith moves the family into the White House, that and indeed it did turn around quite a bit, didn't it?
Well, yes, she saw straight away, for one thing, as soon as she went into the upstairs living quarters. See, they'd never had a family with so many children. There were eight of them altogether, and there simply were not enough bedrooms on that second floor to house them all. Because, I don't know whether you know this at all, but Jefferson had actually constructed, going west from the White House, a colonnade And at the end of that colonnade, there were a few presidential offices where he and his cabinet and so on would meet. That burned down. The colonnade survived. But over the years, a greenhouse had been built over that colonnade, and there were no presidential offices in that west wing area. So the office of the president was in the upstairs living quarters right next to the bedrooms. So all the office seekers and all the people coming to see the president and the cabinet and everything had to come upstairs right next door to the living quarters. And Edith said, this is like living over the store. It's also like living right next door to the store. So she brought in the prestigious New York architectural firm of McKim, Mead & White, who built, you may remember, the magnificent Penn Station that was pulled down in the 1960s. And they set to work. She gave them 6 months to do it. After the morning for McKinley was over, the architects and all the construction crews moved in, and they rebuilt that west wing. They built a new office for Theodore, a new cabinet room, and they built new quarters for them, which included those old offices on the second floor. She made two huge bedrooms, extra bedroom suites up there. She stripped out all the old stuffy carpets, took down all the bulbous chandeliers, and removed all the tufted sofas from the east room. So it was now bare floors, lighter chandeliers, all painted in buff and white. In fact, very much the White House that we know today. And very few people know that it was Edith Roosevelt who did this, because the credit always goes to the Kennedys and to Truman for the big restoration of the White House. But actually, it was done at the turn of the century by the Roosevelts.
And those children, they were a lively bunch. There's wonderful stories in your book about Quentin roller skating around the living quarters.
They saw those shiny floors and they said, goody, goody, and took out their roller skates. And the White House usher was shocked because some of them were walking on stilts and the others were skating. And that's how it was. They were extremely lively. And Edith apparently felt the children should be sort of given their head and just develop naturally. She was sort of enlightened in that way, I guess.
I can just see there's this little anecdote in the book about Quentin roller skating with a snake. And and roller skating into his father's office when his father is meeting with a cabinet member and dropping off the snake and heading out.
Yes, it was probably Alice's snake, actually, because Alice used to have a snake she called Emily Spinach. Emily was the name of her aunt, a rather prim sister of Edith, who lived abroad and only came to visit in summers. And Spinach because of the color, I suppose. And she would put this snake in her purse, and at these high-toned parties, she would suddenly take the snake out, and it would be crawling up her arm and around her neck. She did it to shock.
Well, these are wonderful stories, because when we think of the White House, it's sort of with, you know,
sedate like, and stuffy.
Yes, very much so. Edith, did she share Teddy's interest in wilderness and the outdoors?
She loved to walk, yes, and she always went on his rowing boat trips and everything, and she even went out to the Yellowstone West with him. She enjoyed it, but she didn't have quite the stamina and the physique for it that he did. So, no, she didn't go on all his hunting trips or anything like that, but she was a person who believed in exercise and would swim well into old age. She could still be seen swimming off the coast there in the cove of Oyster Bay.
And she apparently could handle a horse.
Oh, yes, an excellent horsewoman. I asked her daughter about that. I said, what was her horsemanship like? And she said, well, she certainly had good hands and could handle a mount, but she wasn't a first-rate horsewoman because she didn't hunt. That seemed to be the criterion of being first-rate, that she went hunting. But she loved to ride, and she named her horse Jadzenka after the heroine of a Polish romance, which goes to show how widely she read. Because she actually read in every kind of languages and countries, Middle Eastern culture, everything she was familiar with.
When the Roosevelts moved into the White House after the assassination of President McKinley, Theodore was Oh, obviously he was on a man. He was on a mission to get first to Buffalo and then to Washington. What was her role? What was she doing at that point? What were her responsibilities? What were her thoughts and feelings as she's getting the family ready to move?
That's a good question. As you know, Theodore received the news when he was climbing Mount Marcy in the Adirondacks of New York State. And he had to take a buggy ride in driving rain all night long down the mountainside to the station at North Creek and then the train to Buffalo, leaving Edith behind with all the children at their camp in the mountains. So the next day, she had to get those children home. Now imagine, no helicopters, no Secret Service, no limousines, nothing. Just get in the buggy, put the pile of luggage behind, and drive down the mountainside to the station. And then from the station to the Hudson River, where she took an overnight ferry down to Manhattan, and then another train out to Oyster Bay, and then another buggy ride home to Sagamore Hill. This took 24 hours. And she was now the first lady of the land, and she did all of this alone. When she got there, of course, she had to immediately pay attention to the move to Washington because she didn't know anything about the living quarters. And so she went down very quickly for the funeral of McKinley and instantly went back home to finish off the packing. And when she got home, she went into the children's nursery and she saw a row of dolls all lined up on the bed and they all had black armbands. And she said, "What is this?" And the children said, "Oh, the dolls are in mourning for President McKinley." So she packed them all off, and down they went to Washington. And that's when she made the decision that they would have to make these alterations. And that's when they, how they began. I suppose they all had to double up at first in the bedrooms because there really weren't enough.
Yeah. What were her thoughts about the political implications of McKinley's assassination? Do we know?
Well, of course, she was worried stiff. And once when she found that Theodore was getting a little tired-looking, puffy around the eyes, she went out into the Virginia countryside and she bought a little hunting lodge. She paid $190 for a few acres of land with this little hunting lodge. And it's right at the foot of the Blue Hill Mountains, Blue Ridge Mountains. And she asked for a couple of Secret Service detail to go out there because she was terrified that they were there, the two of them alone or with a couple of the children. And one night she went upstairs to bed and she found that her little boy, Archie, had a gun beside his bed. And she said, "What are you doing with this gun?" And he said, "Well, I am protecting Father." So she was terrified, but she had to do everything very secretly because Theodore prided himself on being able to take care of himself. And the story goes that even in church he always carried a revolver. And once when he knelt down, somebody saw the revolver poking out the back of his jacket. But it was a scare. It was the anarchism at that time was frightening, similar to what we're going through right now with foreign groups infiltrating our society and taking advantage of our free institutions.
You begin one of the chapters in the book with a quote from Henry Adams. "The American woman of the 19th century was much better company than the American man." What kind of company was Edith, and was she interested, if so, how much so, in politics and current events?
I think that probably the reason he said that the cultivated woman at the time, the woman with plenty of time to read, could read a lot more than the husband who were busy out there earning a living. And, of course, in the days when they all had so many servants, I often thought that the secret of their productivity, T.R.'s particularly, was due to the servant class, because they had not only cooks and parlor maids and tutors for the children, but they had an army of people just taking care of the running of the household, the laundry and everything else. So Edith had plenty of time for reading, and that's why Henry Adams loved her company and that of many other women of the period. Henry Cabot Lodge's wife, apparently, was extremely well-read and fluent in several languages. So I think that's what that remark meant, but it, of course, only applied to the leisured classes and the cultivated ones.
Would these women have talked politics?
they did to a degree, because they would hear so much, I suppose. They would hear so much of the men talking politics that they became well-informed willy-nilly, whether they liked it or not. But I think in Edith's case, in terms of policy, influencing policy, I doubt it, except that I do know she kept in touch with foreign diplomats whom she befriended during their time in Washington, because they were there in Washington altogether 14 years in his various jobs as Civil Service mm-hmm. Commissioner and then Assistant Secretary of the Navy and then Vice President and President. Total 14 years. She made a lot of friendships at the embassies. So she kept in touch by correspondence, and she knew what was going on in England and in France and in Russia and in Germany. And she certainly would pass that information on to Theodore. But her real strength came in being able to handle personnel, rather like Nancy Reagan with Ronald Reagan. Theodore and Ronald Reagan both loved everybody, and they were sort of totally indiscriminate in their affections towards people. So it was their wives who had to look out for predatory mm. people who weren't necessarily wishing their husbands good.
Mm.
So they both are very similar in that regard, mm. I think, and that they understood character a little bit more than their husbands did.
And it seems to me that both of them had, while they're in the White House, had a great, great talents, great abilities for managing all manner of detail.
Yes. In fact, Edith was the first one to have a social secretary, to see that the mm. First Lady really, to keep her appointment book and to be able to entertain on the scale that she did, because they had hundreds of people to these music halls, for example. And it got to the point where she was so efficient that even the president's sisters had to make appointments.
You mentioned that Edith kept in contact with diplomats, and this is really fascinating. This is a fascinating portion of the book. She became quite an interesting partner in her husband's diplomatic efforts, because correspondence could come to her that then she would get to the president. And the British diplomat, Spring Rice,
yes,
greatly admired her abilities.
Yes, he did. And Theodore himself said that he thought his wife was greater among women than he was among men. She was clever, you see, and Springy and all those people were devoted to her, because she was a good correspondent, a good letter writer, and although she was quiet and gentle, she was as sharp as can be intellectually. So they all treated her as an equal, mm. just as they did Theodore.
Mm. What was the relationship between that British diplomat and Theodore? What was the importance of that relationship?
Well, he had always wanted Spring Rice, who was a minor diplomat at the embassy when they first met, and never became, he always hoped he'd become ambassador to Washington, the British ambassador to Washington. He never made the cut. He did end up in Russia. And hence that correspondent, that important correspondence as to what was going on in Russia, particularly during the 1905-1906 Russo-Japanese War, which, you may recall, was mediated in the end by Theodore Roosevelt. And as a result, he won the Nobel Peace Prize mm-hmm. for that, bringing that war to an end. But Edith certainly kept up with what was going on in Russia, in Russian diplomatic circles, and passed on that information to Theodore. Spring Rice actually had been the best man at their wedding. And there's a funny story in the book where they were jogging along in a coach and four on their way to St. George's Hanover Square, where Edith was waiting at the end of the nave for her husband to appear, and it was foggy. And Spring Rice suddenly realized that Theodore didn't have any gloves, and he thought this was really inappropriate. He wasn't properly dressed. So he stopped the carriage, dashed into a haberdasher's shop, and bought a pair of orange gloves. So when Theodore entered the church and began to walk up the nave, all she could see through the sort of rather foggy atmosphere was these orange gloves.
Well, what was life for them after the White House? I know that, you know, Theodore decided not to seek election for a second term. He'd come into the White House and served the remainder of McKinley's term, and then he was reelected, but then he decided that he wouldn't seek reelection. And as Edmund Morris told us yesterday, that was a great decision on Theodore Roosevelt's part. But it was very hard on him, ultimately. I wonder what those years out of political life before the 1912 run, the independent run, the third party run for the White House were like for this couple.
Well, Edith, of course, knew that was a terrible mistake because he made the, after a landslide victory in 1904, having only completed McKinley's term, so that, strictly speaking, didn't count, right at the beginning of his only real term of his own, he made the decision that he wouldn't run again in 1908 because he felt that Washington, the father of the country, had set up this precedent that really two terms was enough and that power corrupted and it wasn't a good thing for the country. The power must be handed back. And he made that decision, in effect, making himself a lame duck president for his whole second term. And Edith knew this was a terrible mistake. And but, of course, it was too late. He'd done it and he had to keep his word. So he left office in 1908 when he could actually have had another term of his own on a silver platter. Mm-hmm. But he did honor his commitment and he left. But of course, he was the kind of person that was sweet and nice when he was in power. But he was the kind of person who festered when he was out of it because his natural element was to govern. So he was never happy and his personality was never at its best when he wasn't in a position to govern. So as soon as he got to Africa and he did his safari, I suppose he was kept pretty occupied there, but that 9 months came to an end. And while he was away, he was already getting letters from people saying how Taft was not running the country the way that Theodore would have liked. So he almost made a decision almost immediately to challenge Taft for the nomination in 1912, which of course was another act of hubris. Because he split the party and did what nobody wanted in the Republican Party, which was to elect Woodrow Wilson. Mm. So it was a big beginning of this great tragedy, which was the last decade of his life. And it was brought about by that act of hubris, that fatal insolence, as the Greeks would say, of running against your own party. And he went into decline from then on. It's a very sad story. Mm. It's really of Greek tragic proportions, I think, because he's a man who fell from a great height.
Did their marriage suffer as a result?
Strangely, not. They were always so companionable. And right at the very end, there's a touching scene in my book where apparently he would, every night when they were sitting reading in the big north room at Sagamore Hill with the fires going, he would go over to Edith and he would say, "A little bit of chocolate, broken in two." And so you just see them there, sitting side by side with their books. Mm. Children, of course, all gone now. As Edward Arlington Robinson wrote in a poem once, they've all gone away from the house on the hill. And it certainly applied to Sagamore Hill at that time. It must have been a somewhat sad place at the end.
Yeah. They were married for more than 30 years, and they'd grown up together as children. They'd been sweethearts when they were teenagers.
Yes. In the end, they'd known each other for like 54 years they were together, when you think about it, from when she was 3 or 4 years old, and he died when he was 60. He'd always said that he would die at 60. His mother was told when he was a child that he wouldn't live beyond 3 because he was asthmatic and he had a bad heart. And the doctor at Harvard said the same thing. He said, "Theodore, you're going to have to lead a sedentary life because you're not a healthy person." And he said he was going to disobey that. He would do everything the doctor told him not to do. He said, "I'll live up to the hilt until I'm 60 and then I'll die." And that's exactly what he did.
Hmm.
Just 60 years old. And of course, she went on to 87.
Right. So he died in 1919 and then she had decades of life as a widow.
48 she died, yes. An incredible life. I've often thought it would make a great miniseries because Theodore being born in 1858 and she dying in 1948, you know, that's almost 100 years of American history. It's a lot in a country which is only just over 200 years old. They covered almost half the country's history between them.
Yeah. Well, she was born as the Civil War was beginning.
Yes.
And she died after the Second World War.
Yes, she saw the atomic bomb drop, you see, on her birthday, as a matter of fact. August 6th, 1945, on her birthday, they dropped the atomic bomb. And that, of course, was devastating to her, that she could have lived to see that, and then to live to see some of her children die in the world wars. You know, your children aren't supposed to die before you, but she certainly endured that, and was strong to the end, really.
She was strong to the end. There's a scene near the end where she is being interviewed by a journalist, and he's quite taken with her. And by this time, she's in her 80s, is she not?
Oh, yes, yes, indeed. And it was Stefan Laurent, the picture journalist, and he took her a photograph. He was trying to identify something, and he showed her this picture of Cornelius Van Schaick Roosevelt's house on Union Square. At the time of Lincoln's funeral, and the procession, Lincoln's funeral procession, came into New York, and it processed up Broadway past this house. And there's a photograph that he showed her of the Roosevelt mansion and two little boys looking out of the window down onto Lincoln's funeral. And as soon as he showed her this picture, she said, "Oh, yes, absolutely, I was there. I was with the boys. I was 4 years old," she said. And I was looking out of the window with them, and when I saw the black catafalque and the coffin and all the black soldiers, she said, I burst into tears, and they locked me in a cupboard and said, "You silly girl, driveling like that. You're not going to see the funeral." They locked her up, and she remembered that. And Stefan Laurent was so charmed by her. He said, "You know, Mrs. Roosevelt, if I were 10 years older, I would propose to you." And she, quick as a whip, said, "And if I were 10 years younger, I would accept." So she had this feistiness right to the end.
Mm. Well, I'm so glad now that we know about this woman and what a remarkable woman she was. The two of you, you and your husband, both of you being biographers, and both of you being so interested in the lives of the Roosevelts, what's that like for a couple to be immersed in the lives of one particular family for a good number of years?
Well, I'll tell you a funny story against myself somewhat. When I was promoting the book originally, when it came out in originally 1980, I did a slideshow, slides, and I would give these talks with slides. And once I was practicing, I was timing. They had to go an hour or something, and I was timing it, so I was sort of saying my commentary, flashing the pictures on the screen at home, and I began to say, "When I moved into the White House, I began to sketch the upstairs." My husband came rushing, he said, "What are you saying? You're saying I." And I think my identification with the character, having lived with her for so many years, I've begun to identify so strongly with her, and I was so sympathetic toward her, that I almost adopted her identity. It was a very strange feeling. So that, I don't know whether that answers your question, but you do get so immersed in these lives that you really have no life of your own while you're doing those books. You sacrifice your own family life, your friendships. Everything goes by the board, and you really move into the life of those other people, particularly if they have living relatives whom you have to keep interviewing and seeing and working with documents on. And so I think it sort of takes over your own life.
Mm. Isn't it interesting that Edmund's books are written in the present tense?
Yes. Yes. That's true too, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
There's no hindsight, no leaping forward in time. They're all written in real time. Yes.
So we are there.
Yes. My book on Claire Luce, of course, I knew Claire Luce. That was the difference there. At least Edith was dead when I wrote about her. But when I wrote about Claire Luce, she was alive, and I knew her for those last 7 years of her life. And that was very strange. She once said to me, asked me who I felt closest to. And I said, before I could actually answer, say, "Well, of course, my husband or my sister," she said, "But I feel closest to you because you know everything."
Hmm.
And that was a chilling chilling remark, I thought, that if you're writing about a live person, they can almost begin to feel closer to their biographer because their biographer begins to know more than even their nearest relatives. Because you go back further in time, you see. Mm-hmm. You investigate mm-hmm. their childhood.
Mm-hmm. Read their letters.
Things they've even forgotten themselves.
Yeah. Are you working on a biography now?
Yes, I'm doing volume 2 of Claire Breslue now.
Good. Because I know the first one gets us to the 40s.
Yes, when she gets to Congress.
Yeah.
That's why I called it The Ascent of Claire Breslue, because things got bad after that. So I had to end it there.
Yeah. Well, bad but interesting.
Yeah, very interesting.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Sylvia Jukes Morris has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of Edith Kermit Roosevelt, Portrait of a First Lady. It's out in a paperback edition from the Modern Library. She's also the author of a biography of Claire Booth Luce, Rage for Fame, The Ascent of Claire Booth Luce.